Okay, we are just starting into our third session on this new series. In these three sessions, it's actually a follow-up from a new teaching that we'll be offering to everyone all at the same time, along with the DVD from just a couple of weeks ago in Michigan. And this teaching has taken us into Paul's teaching pertaining to the subject, first off, laying the foundation of his teaching on the faith of God and the faith of Christ. We've learned a lot. We've gone in, and of course we've seen that Paul is the teacher of that doctrine, as we know that Paul is the teacher of the doctrine of righteousness and the redemption of the world, all of these things, and grace versus law. He is the teacher of grace. He is the teacher of all of the things that the new covenant really presents. We also know that from past experience in studying in the book of Galatians that there was this battle going on between Paul and the rest of the disciples and Jesus' disciples. I know that that's a hard thing for a lot of people to wrap their mind around, that this was a debate that was going on instead of a, you know, we take the book of James and first and second Peter, first, second, third John, and we make it to make sense with the book of Galatians and the book of Romans, and it just don't make sense. So I'm very proud to say that I'm a teacher of Paul's revelation of the gospel. And I do say that that to the exclusion of Peter, James, and John's understanding of the gospel. Because when Paul made reference to their gospel, he called it another gospel, which is not a gospel at all. Now, that's who he was talking about in the book of Galatians. When he talked to the Galatians and said, "Who hath bewitched you?" He went right on and told them who hath bewitched him, and he called them by name. And he also said that he rebuked Peter to the face about it. So that concept is something that, of course, in my journey of Christianity, I would have never, ever, ever in a million years ever conceived that I would have come to a point to find or to allow myself to see the discrepancies between the teachings of the apostles and of that of Paul's. It's not just in their letters, but it's also in the book of Acts. And Acts chapter 15 was a council that was called to challenge Paul about his teaching to the Gentiles, saying that they did not have to keep the law, where Paul defended his doctrine, and the disciples at that time did not know that the gospel was even for the Gentiles at all. This was some 30 years after the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and they were still, what they were teaching it was only for the Jews. They were still offering animal sacrifices, according to the book of Acts, and what they were requiring Paul to go into as ritual cleansing, which resulted in an animal sacrifice called an offering in the book of Acts. So I'm not ashamed of the gospel. I'm not ashamed of Paul's gospel. I'm not ashamed to say that I see a difference between the gospel, which Paul said is not a gospel, of that of the disciples, and to acknowledge that these guys were in a a doctrinal war. It was not just a doctrinal disagreement. It was a doctrinal war going on for the hearts and minds of people. James obviously went into situations where Paul had taught and tried to refute Paul's doctrine by teaching, "Thou man who says that you're justified by faith alone, show me your faith without your works, and I'll show you my faith by my works," and concludes that Abraham was justified not just by faith, but by his works also. Paul makes the exact opposite statement in Romans chapter 4, I believe it is, that he goes into detail and says that this is Abraham was justified by faith. And he uses terms many times, those who seem to be pillars in the church, and those super apostles. And, we don't have any other characters that are in these letters other than these men, the apostles and Paul. It's obvious that something happened, that maybe even Jesus was concerned about the doctrine that the apostles were preaching, because in the middle of everything, many years after the resurrection, he appeared to Paul on the road to Damascus, and with the church which Peter, James, and John were pastoring and eldering the church at Jerusalem, being only miles away from where Paul's conversion took place. Jesus didn't tell him, now my boys are up in Jerusalem and I need you to go up and learn the gospel from them, because that is the pattern, that we should learn from others who teach others who teach others also. But Jesus did not send Paul into learn from his own disciples. Now, many people can draw whatever they would like from that, but the fact of it is that Paul really had no relationship with disciples. There just wasn't one. He describes the fact that he didn't even see him at all for the first 14 years after his conversion. He says that he spent 3 years out in the wilderness being taught by Jesus himself. Why would Jesus feel the necessity after, teaching 12 disciples and then raising from the dead and teaching them for 40 days? And then why would he feel the necessity to have to come along and bring such a revelation to Paul and then take him to the desert? Why didn't he send him to church? Jesus didn't send Paul to church. He just didn't do it. And there has to be a reason. The reason is borne out, I think, in the process from therein, where that they disagreed with him about, number one, the Gentiles. They just didn't get it. I don't know why they didn't get it. And then also pertaining to the Jews in chapter 21 of Acts, where that they kind of agreed. They agreed with Paul that, yes, the Gentiles can have this too. Big breakthrough for them. But they said, the disciples said, but they still have to keep these four laws. And they were all, their commitment to Judaism was so strong that even of the laws that they told them to give them, three of them were strictly sacrificial ceremonial laws of Judaism. Only one had anything to do with conduct, and it was to abstain from fornication. The rest was nothing to do with anything except Jewish practices of sacrifice and ceremony. And the eating of blood, eating of things, unclean things, and blah, blah, blah. Which, in the Christian world today, the Gentiles pay no attention to at all. And those are the things, if they're going to trust and believe in James's teachings, they need to go back and see what James told the Gentiles they should do, which no Gentile does. Except for maybe abstaining from fornication to the best of their ability, but the rest of them they don't even acknowledge. And but that was pertaining to the Gentiles. Then when it came to the Jews, and they found out that Paul was out teaching that the Jews didn't have to circumcise their children, they had another visitation. All of Paul's encounters with the disciples were in conflict. The only one part that wasn't in conflict was when they left from the meeting with the Gentiles. They extended the right hand of fellowship, but they didn't want Paul going to the Jews. They said, you go to the Gentiles, we'll go to the Jews. And there was a big reason, because they did not want to let, I think they didn't want to let go of the control that they had over the Jews with the law. But then again, they found out that he was preaching that the Jews did not have to circumcise their children. In that particular one where they brought him in, Paul was never allowed to speak. They just told him, you're wrong, and this is why you're wrong. This is what you're going to do, and that's it. So we don't find a place where that there was ever a reconciliation between Paul's teachings and the teachings of the disciples, specifically Peter, James, and John. We do find where that they called each other names. We find where Paul rebuked Peter to the face and said that it was the men that came from Peter, James, and John that deceived you. When he said, "Who has bewitched you?" To the Galatians, he described who that was who had bewitched them. When he said, "Beware of dogs, beware of evildoers, and beware of the concision." Well, the concision was those the disciples, the ones who were teaching. That it's not a stretch to say when he said beware of dogs, beware of evil workers, he was talking about the other disciples because they were the concision. They were the ones who were telling the Jews that they had to circumcise their children still. And Paul viewed that as such an offense to the gospel. He said the people who are deceiving you like this, and Paul called those doctrines absolute deception. And when he said, so they're teaching another gospel, he said it's really not another gospel at all. So he tried to say, I preach one gospel, you preach another gospel. And he said, nah, yours isn't a gospel at all. And I think that's what we're finding out, is that this other stuff is not a gospel at all. It really has no hope, has no revelation in it, it has no wisdom of God in it. It's man's performance, man's belief, man's works, man's righteousness all the way down the line. Paul's teaching breaks from that totally and completely. It's not a minor break, it is an absolute separation, like an earthquake splitting the earth apart, and one thing's on one side and one is on the other. This is not something that melds together. That is what I believe has caused such great confusion in what we call Christian doctrine, is this attempt to meld together the teachings of the disciples and the teachings of Paul. They don't fit. They are almost absolute opposites. In many cases, they are absolute opposites, coming up with the same comparisons with absolute opposite conclusions, such as Abraham being justified. Was it by works or was it by faith alone? So that's what we're dealing with. And this doctrine of Paul's being exclusively a Pauline doctrine, being one that says that it is the faith of Christ that has brought us the righteousness of God. I don't know of a more powerful statement to get across to the world. The fact that the righteousness of God has been brought to us by the faith of Christ. The righteousness of God has been imputed to us by the faith of Christ. The same as that the sin of Adam, the transgression of Adam, had been imputed to us without our participation. By the same token, we have the incredible imparting or imputing. The term impute means to charge or credit to one's account. It can be either way. It's either a charge to your account or a credit to your account. And when you're talking about sin, that's charged against your account. When you're talking about righteousness, it means it's credited to your account. So the two are absolute comparatives. We've been studying a lot in the book of Romans. We're going to go in there a little bit more. Of course, in which the great chapter that is many hold as a cornerstone for the understanding of Paul's doctrine of the redemption of the world, and that's Romans chapter 5, where he did make the comparison between the first and the last Adam. You know, in all reality, there are only two men in God's eyes in history. And that's the first Adam and the last Adam. There's only two men. There's God and there's two men. You don't have to look at the whole world. God viewed the whole world through the first Adam. And everyone knows that that's true. Every church denomination preaches that through one man, God viewed the entire population of the world. Whether they were Jew or Gentile, it made no difference. Even though only the Jew was given God's law, God still saw the entire human race through one Adam, through just one man. And it was all of the seed that came out of Adam's loins that was affected by Adam's deeds. The interesting thing about it is, when you look at the Ephesians doctrine, it is all the seed that went into the loin of Jesus Christ. Because the entire human race was brought into the loins of Jesus Christ whenever he was hanging on the cross. So you see the reverse osmosis, if you will, that the all of the seed that came from Abraham was deemed to be sinners, and all the seed that went into the loin of Jesus hanging on the cross was deemed to be righteous along with him. So this is a very powerful gospel. It's one that is very much easy to declare. It's very simple to communicate. And it's one that causes people to become believers. And when we look at this comparison between the two, and we see that there's just no room for mistake. There's no room for discrepancy here. The biggest thing for me and for you and probably for most everyone is coming to grips with that shocking understanding that these men disagreed with each other. This was not just a big gospel party where everybody was agreeing with each other. These were in sharp disagreement. As you read in Acts 15, it says they were shouting at one another about these very things. Kind of sounds like church today. They're still shouting at one another. But there's no need for any shouting. And the only shouting that ever takes place is really for the very same reason it was taking place then. People get upset about their self-righteousness. They get upset about somebody having righteousness by faith. And this split takes place over and over and over again. The one thing that I do not intend to do is ever water down the gospel that I have come to understand and the gospel that I believe that Paul himself taught, and that I have no reason to compromise it. There's not one. So out of that wonderful revelation of Paul of the two Adams and this incredible ability to see that you cannot apply that one had no choice, the ones who came out of Adam had no choice, and the ones who went into Jesus had a choice. The comparison falls down completely. There just isn't. You can't say that Jesus was greater than the first Adam and people had a choice with him, and the first Adam, that Jesus was greater than him, and when you turn around and say that nobody had a choice in the first Adam, but people have a choice in the second Adam. That would make the first Adam greater in his work. Whatever his work would be, it would be far greater and far more powerful in that it did not include man's will whatsoever. Man's will was not included in determining whether or not that they would be participants or recipients of Adam's transgression. And by Paul's teaching that the rest of the world has no participation and absolutely no say-so about whether or not we are taken into Christ and made righteous through one man's obedience. As we go into this, let's start again in Romans chapter chapter 1. And again, just to reaffirm, we've covered a lot of material. I'm tempted to go back and do a little bit of recap, but we're just going to have to depend that everyone will listen to CD number 2 again before going into this. And again, Paul's dramatic declaration, where he said, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believeth." First off, let's stop there. The gospel is the power of God. What is the gospel? The gospel is, according to Paul, the revelation of the mystery of God and how that the righteousness of God was brought to the entire human race by the faith of Jesus Christ. Now, the salvation he is speaking of is not the salvation that gets you into heaven. It is the salvation that comes to the believer that once they understand the fact that they have been made righteous already, that salvation is of Paul's teaching, which is the vast majority of his teaching about salvation, was the saving of the soul and the renewing of the mind. The power of this gospel that tells you you're already redeemed is the power of God unto salvation, the saving of the soul, the renewing of the mind to everyone that believeth. That is, and that's what we've talked about a great deal during the process of this, is what does our belief and what does our faith do? According to Paul, it saves you. It's your salvation. It is your salvation to understand that which is already fact. That is what salvation is. Salvation is not creating fact that does not exist. Salvation is understanding fact that already exists, or gospel that already exists, or truth that already exists. And he said it'll save your soul unto salvation to everyone that believeth, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Also might defer to Romans chapter 10, where he's already said in Romans chapter 5 that everybody's already been made righteous, but then he prays and says, my heart's prayer and desire toward God is that Israel might be saved. For I declare unto you that they have a form of godliness, but not according to knowledge. For they going about trying to establish their own righteousness have not submitted to the righteousness of God. This is the further explanation of Paul's definition of people needing to get saved. He had already declared in chapter 5 that all of Israel had been redeemed. But he says all of Israel now needs to get saved. These redeemed people need to get saved. Saved from what? Saved from their ignorance of their redemption. Because he said, how can I tell that they're ignorant of the redemption that's already theirs? He said, I can tell because they're still going about trying to establish their own righteousness. You can tell when someone is ignorant of the gospel when they're trying to be righteous by their works. No matter how much they use the name of Jesus, how much they speak in tongues, no matter how much that they pray for the sick, no matter how much they read their Bible, no matter how committed they are, if they are doing anything to try to establish their standing with God by their performance, if they get depressed and guilty because they have failed, those are self-righteous people who have the very same need for salvation that he told that the nation of Israel needed. That Jesus had already died and made them righteous, according to Romans chapter 5, and now he was praying that they would actually get saved now. That they would enter this process of salvation. This process, as Paul said, I now want to apprehend that which I've been apprehended for. He was praying that for them. Israel had also been apprehended by God through Jesus Christ. But he's praying kind of the same prayer that he was praying for himself. I want them to apprehend what they've been apprehended for. I've been apprehended. I want you to be apprehended. I got redeemed. Now I'm getting saved to that knowledge. You've been redeemed. I would love for you to get saved to that knowledge. I would love for all of Israel to get saved to that knowledge. I'd love for the Hindus and the people in the bars and the people in the churches to get saved to this knowledge. Because everyone in church is there, in many cases, doubting their redemption instead of getting saved to the reality of their redemption. He said, for therein is the righteousness of God revealed. Why will the gospel save someone? Because it reveals the righteousness of God. That's why it will save you. That's why it will, as a believer, when you become a believer, if you're taught the gospel, he says that it will save you because it reveals God's righteousness, not man's righteousness. For the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith, as it is written, the just shall live by faith. Now here again, the Pauline default to faith is not your faith. The Pauline default to faith is the faith of God or the faith of Christ. So when the just live by faith, whose faith are they living by? That's the faith of Jesus Christ. That was Paul's testimony himself. He said that he put aside his own righteousness. And then in Galatians chapter 2, remember he said that he'd been redeemed by the faith of Jesus Christ. Exactly how did he put it? Let me read it correctly. He said, I am crucified with Christ, nevertheless I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me, and the life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. So he said, living by faith. What is living by faith? Is it trusting that God's going to send somebody with groceries when you're broke. What is living by faith? We've defined it so many things. Living by faith is being assured and confident that you're righteous and holy before God outside of your own performance and outside of your own faith. That is living by faith. And my goodness, I just say it and there's just a saturation of peace that comes. I am living by faith. It's like my nerves relax. It's like the, my brain relax. Stress begins to relieve. I live by faith. I live by the faith of the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. So this is Paul's doctrine. Now, dropping on down, we could go through so much of this. It's hard to leave anything out. You guys know I'm a chapter by chapter guy. But some of this stuff is just so vitally important, we have to get to it. We will go through this entire chapter as far as I know. Of course, we've already gone 25 minutes. I don't know how that happened. But in Romans chapter 3, he's talking about this whole issue of circumcision and people judging each other and whether circumcision. He goes through this thing in chapter 2, and he said that what prophet has circumcision, and he says that if the uncircumcision keep the righteousness of the law, shall not his uncircumcision be counted as circumcision, and shall not uncircumcision, which is by nature, if it fulfill the law, justify thee, who by the letter of by the letter and circumcision doth transgress the law. He's saying, you make these big issues out of laws, but then you turn right around and you break laws by keeping laws. And it's a never-ending cycle. So then he comes to this, and he's dealing with the Jewish issue. Remember that. He's dealing with people who, for several thousand years, have tried to attain righteousness through the law. And in chapter 3, he says, what advantage then hath the Jew, or what profit is there of circumcision? Much in every way. Chiefly because unto them were the committed the oracles of God, or the commandments of God. Now, the thing that was important about circumcision in Judaism is this one thing, and Paul made it very clear. It's that God gave them his law. That's what was important about it. It wasn't important because of the act of. It was important because of the that's where God gave his law, which through God's law, and you'll see how this chapter closes out, how the importance of it is to be able to embrace God's law to its full. You want to turn that off? We might even be able to cut down some noise on the recording too. So, he says, much in every way, chiefly because unto them were given the oracles or the commandments of God. For what if some did not believe? Now, this is one verse that you will never ever hear taught in church. No place. For what if some did not believe? Shall their unbelief make the faith of God without effect? Now, see, now we're talking about people who are affected by the faith of God. Now, what did we determine? What did Paul determine the faith of God does? The faith of God gives people God's righteousness. But what if some believe not? What if some don't believe? Shall their unbelief make the faith of God without effect? Big question, and it needs desperately to be answered. Can my unbelief, and okay, so I go out and witness to somebody on the streets, which I've done many, many, many times in my life, more than many of my peers, and hours and months and years of being out on streets and knocking on doors and those things. All right, so I've gone up to somebody's door, and I want to lead them to Christ. Now, before, I believed that if they turned me down, they were on their way to hell. But you see, Paul is correcting me here. Paul is correcting me drastically. When he said, now when I walked away and they chose not to become believers, then I deemed that these people were now unrighteous and on their way to hell. But Paul said, shall their unbelief make the faith of God without effect? God forbid. There just isn't a way. Now, you know, that should be underlined, highlighted, you know, put in neon signs up in, on every church bulletin around the world. Can a person's unbelief... Now here again, I just want to challenge again the fact that the NIV Bible and many other, they desperately want this statement, the faith of Christ, out. But I want you to see in context here that just cannot read any other way. He says, shall their unbelief make the faith of God without effect? Now how could it say, how can their faith make the faith in God without effect? You see, there's no comparison. The comparison is lost by taking out the faith of God. And here in the context, you see that this is a desperate... Now, why are they so desperate? Why are they so desperate to neuter this statement? Because if this statement is not neutered, their entire doctrine is based in false concepts. That's why. That's why. They must neuter this statement, the faith of God and the faith of Christ. Because if it remains and if it stands, it means clearly that the entire human race has been made righteous and made holy through the faith of Christ and has been given the righteousness of God through faith. But again, we go through the question. I hate to be redundant, but the fact of it is, these things have not been addressed to the Christian community. And they need to look close, and they need to look well at these. Do not ever allow some religious, self-righteous person try to rob you of Paul's doctrine of the faith of God or the faith of Christ. They need it taken out of the Bible. Now, this is what's so weird. They're sticklers for the Bible, but in this case, they're sticklers to take it out of the Bible. They need it out. They want it out because they recognize right up front that this undermines every doctrine that they teach if this stands in this fashion. It is a battle. And again, this is not just a Greek issue. This is not an issue of the Greek. Context. This is a comparison. So it can't be removed. They do it, but I will not relent. Paul didn't relent, and I'm not going to either. He says, God forbid, yea, let God be true and every man a liar. Now, how many of you have heard that statement, let God be true and every man a liar? Well, it was applied to healing, it was applied to prosperity, it was applied to everything under the sun. But let's keep it in application of context. If someone says that unbelief will cause someone to be unrighteous before God, can that happen? That would make God a liar. It would make God a liar if someone's unbelief could nullify the fact that he made them righteous. That would make God a liar. I'm going to say it. The entire Christian world, by saying that it is your faith that makes you righteous and your unbelief makes you unrighteous, they are calling God a liar. Now, I'm going to stand on the other side of this issue. And I'm going to call them liars. I'd rather call them liars than God. God is not a liar. God is not a man that he should lie. And this is the lie. This is the big lie. If we've ever dealt with the big lie, you know, everybody's always talking about the big lie. This is the big lie that perpetrates Christianity. And it's this issue of faith. The issue of what, by what means, you know, they're even divided about whether it's by faith or just by works. Honey, we blew past that one years ago and know that it is only by faith. But even the ones who believe it's by faith think it's their faith. And that makes God a liar. I don't know how more profoundly straightforward it can be said. If a man says that any man's unbelief can undo the faith of God, which we know Paul's teaching, faith, the faith of Christ has given man the righteousness of God, can man's unbelief make that null and void? No. Let God be true and every man a liar. I like it when it's clear like that, don't you? As it is written, that thou mightest be justified in thy sayings and mightest overcome when thou art judged. Oh my goodness. Oh gosh. You know what? If you accept the fact that you are righteous before God based in what on his faith, he says, then the thing that follows that, he says that you might overcome when you're judged. Jeez. Isn't that good news? You will not be able to overcome when you're judged by other people if you're basing your righteousness in your own faith. You can't overcome it. It will devastate you to be judged by other people. But you know what? When you realize where your righteousness comes from, when other people judge you, it's like water off a duck's back. Number one, the moment they judged you, what have they done? They've broken every law in the book. Because the law was never given for a man to judge another man. Do you know that 99.99% of the Christian world do not know that the law was given only for a man to judge himself? They do not know it. They will not accept it. And preachers stand up and judge. Every time a preacher stands up and points out people breaking laws, rules, and regulations, that preacher is dishonoring God and his laws by even pointing out someone else's fault. God's law was never meant for a preacher to use to point out someone's fault. It was given for that man to judge himself by, not to judge others by. But if our righteousness commend the righteousness of God, what shall we say? If, in other words, if I'm righteous through my own faith, if that commends the righteousness of God, what shall we say? Is God unrighteous to take vengeance? I speak as a man. All right, now, Paul's saying if this is all true, if the way they say it is all true, he said, then is God unrighteous to take vengeance? But if our righteousness commend the righteousness of God, what shall we say? Is God unrighteous to take vengeance? I speak as a man. Now, he's saying, if these things are true, then does that make God unrighteous by taking vengeance? If God is the only one who gives righteousness and men are unrighteous by their own faith, is God then wrong by taking vengeance against righteousness? He's saying, I speak as a man, or I'm speaking as a man who teaches God's laws. God forbid. For then, how shall God judge the world? Now, God is not going to judge the world. Remember, he said he is speaking as a man. He's speaking and trying to bring a conclusion to these people's way of thinking. For if the truth of God hath abounded through my lie unto his glory, why yet am I judged as a sinner? Now, he said, now wait a minute, folks. He says, now if the fact that if God is righteous by measuring the fact that I am unrighteous, if that is the means by which we declare God to be righteous by measuring him against a human, then is my lie what is giving glory to God? He's carrying this to its utter foolish end. We call God righteous. We must call people unrighteous. And he's saying, if by comparison then, if we're comparing this way, and my lie, me breaking God's law, makes me unrighteous, then isn't it my lie that's giving glory to God so he can be righteous? See? So we think we're honoring God when we're actually dishonoring God through these comparisons. He said, for if the truth of God hath more abounded through my lie unto his glory, why yet am I also judged as a sinner? Why am I called a sinner when what I'm doing is actually causing God to be God? There's no sense in that. And not rather as we are, and this is where he picks up, where he is being accused, and we know who he's being accused by. He made it clear in the book of Galatians who was accusing him of saying these things. And not rather as we be slanderously reported, as some affirm that we say, let us do evil that good may come, whose damnation or their condemnation is just. Now that condemnation or damnation, he's not talking about being damned or condemned by God. It's the condemnation they're going to live under the law by accusing and judging. Because what happens when you judge somebody else by the law? That judgment comes back on you. It's just a dynamic of the law that no one will be able to ever take away. What then? Are we better than they? No, in no wise. For we have before proved both Jew and Gentile that they are all under sin. All right. So here he's showing where that you can't have a group on planet Earth, you can't have a group of sinners and a group of righteous people. That the dividing mark is the cross. You can't have a group of people who under Adam, some of them are righteous and some of them are sinners. You can't have a group of people after the cross that some of them are righteous and some of them are sinners. Because the dividing line, you can't have both groups on the face of planet Earth at the same time. All right. He says, what then? Are we better than they? No, and no wise. For we have proven both Jew and Gentile that they are all under sin. So when we talk about something being completely under sin, it is in a situation of being to being under sin. He's not talking about this covenant. So where were all Jews and all Gentiles declared to be under sin? That was under the first covenant, under the first Adam. He said, as it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. So what Paul's dealing with here is that this comparison of man's righteousness to God's righteousness, if we can be righteous on our own, and then our failures in righteousness, that is what causes God to look better. You know, it's kind of like, I've got friends who, well, I don't have friends. I know of people, I do have friends, but it's not the ones I'm talking about. I know of people who, to make themselves look good, they hang around people who are not as attractive as they are. I'm sure you've seen people like that. I mean, people do all kinds of crazy things. To make themselves look good, they hang around something that is lesser than them. And if that is the merit by which we gain our identity, or if that's the merit by which God gains his identity, is by being able to hang around those lesser than himself, what kind of God is that? And that's the issue, I think, that Paul is trying to get to. He says, there is none righteous, no, not one. And how soon do we have to go? Right now? Yes, we can. No problem. So as we see here, Paul has given us that the dividing line, again, is not between between sinners and righteous people under Adam and sinners and righteous people under the second Adam. He's said we've concluded that under the first Adam, that both Jew and Gentile are all sinners. All are concluded. Now, how foolish would it be for him to be bringing about that point if the absolute opposite were not true? The importance that the and that was what he was getting at. If this has gotten a little bit muddled in through the middle of it, this was the point that he was trying to get to. And he said that we've concluded that under the law that all are sinners, Jew and Gentile are sinners. Well, there was the Gentile was never given the law, but the fact is, the conclusion is that all are sinners. By comparison then, as this is chapter 3, and by chapter 5 is where he concludes that all under Christ, or everyone through the obedience of Christ, has been made righteous. Okay, so he's cutting through some pretty weighty stuff here with this, with the issues of legalism and with self-righteousness. And he says the conclusion, therefore, is, in verse 10, as it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. Now, who is not righteous? No one. Even those who are seeking to be righteous through the law, they are not righteous. There is none that understandeth. Who does not understand? These are people who have sought to be righteous through God's laws. They have no understanding. Now, remember what we learned earlier about how that when you understand, when you your faith is applied to simply conceiving the fact that it's the faith of God that has brought you the righteousness of God, that it brings understanding, it brings this confidence, it brings, it opens up a whole world to you. There's none that understandeth, there is none that seeketh after God. Now, why would they not be seeking after God? Man, I tell you, once you found out what God thinks about you, why would you seek after him anymore? I mean, you know, why would you seek out someone whose opinion of you was that you were unrighteous, unholy? I mean, that's why relationships break up, as you begin to hear these negative opinions. They are all gone out of the way. They are to be altogether become unprofitable. Isn't that amazing? These are the results of legalism. They have altogether become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. No matter how hard they're struggling to do it, you wind up doing no good at all. Now look what else he says. Their throat is an open sepulcher. Now who are these people? These are people who are attempting righteousness through the law and even preaching it. Their throat has become an open sepulcher. Now, the law is the ministration of death, right? Isn't that what Paul says? The law is the ministration of death. So if someone is preaching the law out of their mouth, what does that make their throat? It's a sepulcher. That's what Paul's making reference to. He's not talking about people who are using dirty language or something and saying curse words. He's talking about this doctrinal belief that people open their mouths with. He says, with their tongues they use deceit. Oh my goodness. Deceitfulness is in legalism. Nothing but deceitfulness. The next one he says, the poison of asps is under their tongues. Now, if you take the biblical principle of the snake, where's our first revelation of a snake? All right, that's in the garden. All right, the deceit of the asp is under their tongue. This is so profound. This is so simple, though. And what did the snake do in the garden? It tried to convince Adam to do something, to become something that he already was. Right? So what does legalists teach? They try to teach you to do something, to become something that you already are. What is that? The poison of asp, or the snake, is under their lips. And that is a poison. I tell you what, the greatest poison on earth is not arsenic. The greatest poison on earth is legalism. Because it's a poison that it won't kill you instantly, but it'll kill your joy, it'll kill your peace, it'll kill your understanding, your confidence. In all of these wonderful things that we've learned can be a result of this incredible fruit of the righteousness of God. He says it just totally annihilates it completely, and it just and there just is no way that it's going to be there. He said, whose mouths are full of cursing. Now, the term cursing here doesn't mean they're saying blank, 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 expletive, expletive, expletive. The term cursing here, in the Greek word, actually denotes one approaching heaven, addressing heaven, with a question expecting a negative response. the response is expected to be negative. You know, suddenly I hear, you know, John Hagee on TV. I'm sorry, but I hear John Hagee, I could use a number of others, saying, do you actually think that somebody who's caught in a bar when Jesus comes back is going to go to heaven? Well, you see, they're addressing heaven, and they're expecting a negative response. Well, their expectation is wrong. The response would not be negative. Number one, the fact is Jesus has already made a dramatic second coming when he rose from the dead. If there's another one to come, we'll wait and see. But I think the second one he did already is quite drastic. But you see, they approach heaven with the expectation of a negative response. They don't expect anything positive. And with bitterness. The term bitterness, we did an extensive teaching on the chastening of the Lord several years ago, and went on into how that as long as someone, and you'd have to read it in this context, how that if someone believes that the negative things happening in their life is the chastening of the Lord, he's saying, let that be healed. Let that whole concept be taken away. He said, lest a root of bitterness spring up and defile many. Now, we all heard about the root of bitterness. Remember, it was about being mad at the preacher or the preacher's wife or mad at somebody, and you got bitter about this or bitter about that. The root of bitterness springing up has nothing to do with anything about people. It's having a root of bitterness towards God. Because if you're trying your best to live your life, and then you come along and your kid's sick, and somebody says it's the chastening of the Lord, or you lose your husband, or you go through a divorce, and they say, well, it's the Lord's chastening. You lose your finances, it's the chastening of the Lord. Paul said, you better stop that stuff, because if you don't, a root of bitterness is going to spring up and defile many. And my God, we're living in that right now. In that bitterness, that because people are preaching the chastening of the Lord, and that bitterness that comes out, their mouth is full of bitterness, he said. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Isn't that amazing? You know, legalists want war. They want the right people to kill the wrong people. It's just there's no wisdom, there's no understanding. I'm not claiming to have an answer to the war that we're in, but I can tell you that we've been in a war where people's feet have been swift to shed blood. Let's do that first. Let's shed blood first and then talk about it later, because we're right, they're wrong, so let's just take care of it that way. But and in many other situations that we could talk about. Their feet are swift to shed blood. You know, he's not talking about Charles Manson here. He's not. Do you see any place in chapter 1, 2, 3 at all where he's talking about people who are out murdering people and doing horrible things? No, it's not there. He's talking about people who are attempting righteousness through their own deeds. Destruction and misery are in their ways. Oh my gosh. Misery. That word identifies a legalist. They're just miserable people. They're just miserable. And he says destruction and misery are in their ways. It's just everything is, it's just destructive. They say it's beneficial, but it's destructive. And the misery. Now, why is it all this way? Why is it all this way? And the way of peace they have not known. Now, I'd wager to say he's talking about the gospel of peace, not just the way of tranquility, but Paul taught the gospel of peace. Why are these people in this situation? Why is their pursuit for righteousness wound up in such a horrible situation? Because they don't know the gospel of peace. And there is no fear of God before their eyes. Now, the term fear of God is, in most cases, and here also, it simply means a reverence or a worship for God. They don't worship God. They worship themselves. Self-righteous people may claim to worship God, but when you're measuring your righteousness by your works, you're worshiping yourself. As Paul said, it has a good show of will worship. You're worshiping your own will. But he says it doesn't profit anybody anything. And then, of course, the verses that we know quite well, we're going to read right through those. He says, now we know that what things soever the law saith, it saith to them that are under the law. Don't you think it's interesting that in verse 19 he says, now we know that whatsoever things the law saith. If this is all about people who don't keep the law, why does he then go in to say, now we know that whatsoever the things the law saith, it saith to them that are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped. From what? The poison of asps is under their lips. With their tongues they use deceit. Their throat is an open sepulcher. Do you see every bit of that? Whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Do you see that the majority of these things are about things that come out of their mouths? And then he says the law was given to shut their mouths. But you see, they did not honor God's law. You know why they didn't honor God's law? They added a little bit of mercy, a little bit of grace to God's law. Or what they called fence laws. That if you do this, then you do that, well, then it's okay that you did that, and that nullifies this. And that's watering God's law down. God's law should stand as it was given, and that was to condemn the entire human race, as Paul says. It saith to them who are under the law that every mouth may be stopped and that all the world may become guilty before God. How much? The entire world become guilty before God. Therefore, by the deeds of the law shall no flesh be justified in his sight. It's because of these things. How can something which leads you into guilt lead to justification? It cannot happen. The law was given to produce guilt, not justification. If it was given to make everybody guilty, how can it lead to justification? It does not. Therefore, by the deeds of the law shall no flesh be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. The knowledge of sin leads you to guilt. Now, here's another thing. Guilt not only will never lead to justification, the life application of that is that we try to make somebody feel guilty to lead them to a good place in life. It ain't going to happen. You can't guilt somebody into a good place. You can guilt them into a fake place. You can guilt them into lying. You can guilt them into tricking you. You can guilt them to having all of this stuff coming out of their mouth. But you can't guilt them into what you want them to do. Now, it's a tool we all know how to use. However, even though we think we use it well, the fact of it is it never leads to anything good. Therefore, by the deeds of the law, shall no flesh be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. Now, we're picking up on the teaching that we did before we started this three-tape series. So those that have heard that first tape are now hearing some of the things we taught on that, but into a bit more detail. Verse 21, but now the righteousness of God without the law is manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets. The righteousness of God is manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets. Does the law have a role in today's world? Yeah, it's a witness. It has witnessed the fact you have become righteous without it. That's the only role that the law plays. Verse 22, even the righteousness of God, which is by faith of Jesus Christ. Once again, what did he say? Even the righteousness of God, God's righteousness is by Jesus' faith. Remember, we went through that again in the other verses we went through. I can't tell you exactly where they were, but remember he said that it's through the faith of Jesus Christ that we have been given the righteousness of God. And here he says the same thing, even the righteousness of God, which is by faith of Jesus Christ, unto all and upon all them that believe. Now, the righteousness of God has already come through the faith of Christ, but it's the believer who's able to implement that understanding into his life. It's the believer that's able to do that. And instead of the other way around. So, even the righteousness of God, which is by faith of Jesus Christ unto all and upon all them that believe. Believing is important. But you see, even in this verse, it affirms that believing doesn't make you righteous. The righteousness is given. The believer is the one who is the partaker of the application of the righteousness. His faith does not make him righteous, as Paul has stated even in this verse. For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. Now, all have sinned and come short of God's glory. In which covenant? Under this covenant? No, it's under the first covenant, as he is bringing the comparison here between the righteous and the unrighteous. It's not the righteous and the unrighteousness under the law. It's not the righteous or the unrighteous after Christ. It's the unrighteous before Christ under Adam and the righteous who are made righteous after Christ. In verse 24, he says, being justified freely by his grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God has set forth to be a propitiation through faith in his blood, to declare his righteousness for the remission of sins that are past through the forbearance of God. Now, this is talking about your faith now. He says in verse 25, whom God has set forth to be a propitiation through faith in his blood to declare. Now, when your faith is enacted based on what his faith has brought you, what does your faith give you the ability to do? To declare. You see, our faith is one that gives us that confidence. It gives us that peace. It gives us all those things. And here he says that our faith in his blood to declare something. I have enough faith that I can go out and declare it. And not be ashamed of it, as Paul said a chapter back from here. To declare his righteousness for the remission of sins that are passed through the forbearance of God. To declare, I say at this time, his righteousness. Now, your belief in him does what? Gives you the ability to declare, to declare, to declare. I say at this time his righteousness, that he might be the just and the justifier of him which believeth in Jesus. Again, this is saying exactly the same thing. The justifier wants you to believe because that's the only way you're going to know you're justified. This is the means by which we apprehend the justification. It is through our faith that we apprehend it, but it is not our faith that causes us to be apprehended by it. It has already apprehended us. Where is boasting then? It's excluded. Thank God. By what law? Of works? Nay, but by the law of faith. Law of faith has taken away all boasting. Therefore, we conclude that a man is justified by faith without the deeds of the law. By whose faith? All right. We are justified by the faith of Christ without the deeds of the law. Is he the God of the Jews only? Is he not also the God of the Gentiles? Yes, of the Gentiles also. Now remember, what did he conclude about all Jews and all Gentiles after the first Adam? There's none righteous. They're all in sin. All Jews, all Gentiles after the first Adam, under the law, whether they had the law, didn't have the law or not, all were concluded to be under sin. Now he's comparing all Jews and all Gentiles on this side of the cross. He said, verse 29 again, he said, is he the God of the Jews only? Is he not also of the Gentiles? Yes, of the Gentiles also. Seeing it is one God which shall justify the circumcision through faith and the uncircumcision through faith. Through whose faith? It is the faith of Christ that the Jews and the Gentiles are justified. He says, do we then make void the law? Through faith. And then verse 31, do we then make void the law through faith? God forbid, yea, we establish. We're the ones that actually give validity to the law. Because we don't use the law for any purpose other than what it was given for. The law was not given to try to straighten out my life or show me how to live or to make me righteous. I use the law I let stand. You see, most people will take their area of failure to obedience to the law. And you know churches like this. I mean, they spring up everywhere. You know, at first, it's this horrible sin to get a divorce until half the congregation gets divorced. And then suddenly they embrace that, and that's not really a sin no more. That's not wrong. Oh, goodness, you get in an area and it's the issue of being gay until you get a lot of rich gay people in church, and then suddenly being gay is not all that big of a problem. It can go on forever and ever. We have to come up with these exclusions. But you see, we who believe in this justification of God's righteousness through Christ's faith, we know the law condemns everybody. The law lets nobody out. Everything is condemned by the law. Everybody is condemned by the law. There is no one who is going to escape from this in any degree, no matter what. That's just all there is to it. Now, just in closing, I want to read just a couple more verses in Galatians, because Paul says exactly the same thing right here. We read right around it. He says, knowing that a man is not justified by the works of the law, but by faith of Jesus Christ, even we have believed in Christ, that we might be justified by the faith of Christ, and not by the works of the law. For by the works of the law shall no flesh be justified. But if while we seek to be justified by Christ, we ourselves are found sinners, is therefore Christ the minister of sin. So he's saying, is it possible? If I say I'm justified by Christ and yet I'm still a sinner, that makes Christ the minister of sin. You can't have both on either side. Would that mean if there was somebody righteous under the old covenant, does that mean that Adam was the minister of righteousness? If they did good, of course not. If someone could be declared to be a sinner under Christ, does that make Christ the minister of sin? God forbid. For if I build again that which I destroyed, I make myself a transgressor. He's not a transgressor in the eyes of God. Paul said, if I go back and rebuild the legalism that I left behind, he said, I make myself a transgressor. For I, through the law, am dead to the law, that I might live unto God.